Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, what do the Germans know about raising kids that we don't and should? Sarah Zaske got an early lesson on that in Berlin when her infant son wouldn't sleep through the night. Her doctor prescribed a sleep consultant, and when Catherine arrived, she taught the Zaskes how to say no. Sarah writes in her new book that German parenting is about independence and trust. In America, we might call this free-range parenting, but in Germany, it's normal parenting. German parents believe that independence is good for children, that handling risk is a necessary part of growing up. So as Sarah joins us and clinical psychologist Bobby Wegner joins us, I think we'd like to hear from you as well. Do you think the culture of American parenting is too cautious, too hovering, too shaming? Do you think we've created a culture of control, as Sarah writes? And I wonder if this resonates in your own household. 651-227-6000. Instilling self-reliance in kids. Do Americans have something to learn on this? 800-242-2828. What do you make of this as a parent? What do you make of this as an observant American on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Sarah Zaske's a journalist. The new book is called Achtung Baby, and she is with us from Moscow, Idaho. And Sarah, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Bobby Wegner is with us. She's a clinical psychologist and lecturer at Harvard Grad School of Education and Child Advocacy, and she's with us from Boston. And Bobby, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Great. I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Sarah, I want to go back to the moment when the wise Catherine shows up at your apartment and your son's about a year old and he hasn't been sleeping through the night. And Catherine comes in to show you what?
Well, at first she observed what we did and she told me, I want to see what happens when you tell him no. And when I told my son no, sometimes he would have a full-on tantrum, like cartoon tantrum on the floor, fists wailing. And she said, oh, that's a problem. He has to learn how to accept no calmly from you first.
I mean, without realizing it, it appears that you had ceded a lot of authority to your one-year-old, right? I mean, you didn't intend to do that, I don't think, but you were doing whatever you could to avoid the tantrums. Is that a fair way to put it?
Mostly, or I just didn't understand why he was still tantruming over simple no's. And what she told me was that I was comforting him too quickly when he had a tantrum, so that he was like, I'm acting out, and then mom will give me attention. So she told me to wait until he calmed down before I comfort him.
Bobby, how does this sound to you as far as the advice that American parents get about when to intervene, how long to let the kid be uncomfortable, to be throwing a tantrum, whatever?
Yeah, we're at this place in our culture right now where we really prioritize kids in some ways and give them in some ways like almost too much say and too much voice. And it's not to come down really hard on children and say, like, I'm in charge always and you have no say, but it's really important for parents to establish the role of parent and from taking an authoritative position, which is, I'm here, I'm in charge, and, you know, I trust you, I love you, and there's lots of freedom in between to have your own choices, but at the end of the day, it's really up to me to make the decisions in the house.
And Bobby, that all sounds good until, as Sarah says, your kid is throwing a cartoon tantrum, right? The screaming, the waving of the fists, and you just want it to end. I mean, what do you do then?
So that's where I think, a lot of parents that I work with, they come in and they feel incredibly anxious and they feel like they're doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I encourage them that that's actually good parenting in some way, to not necessarily reinforce that behavior. So you set your limit, you set your expectation, and then it's a lot about parents managing their own anxiety and watching their kid be distressed. And although it might be helpful to feel like you're, it might soothe the parents in some ways to care for their child in that moment, it's really at the detriment of kind of like long-term coping, developing longer-term coping skills.
Yeah, let me grab a call here from Sharon in Rochester, because Sharon, I think what we were saying, what Bobby was saying about anxiety resonates with you, yeah?
Absolutely. I'm a therapist. I'm so glad you're having this conversation. The long-reaching things that I see is that this, the hovering and the overparenting, creates very anxious and dependent young adults. All they know is that the parents are competent, not that they are. And so then they try to go off to college or whatever, and it's overwhelming, and they tend to not do very well and tend to suffer from a lot of anxiety. So I really think that our competency comes from trying and failing and fixing it. And if parents would just kind of get out of a kid's way to learn that, it really creates competent adults.
Sharon, you referred to this as overparenting. Did I hear that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, what is that, in your view, as a therapist?
What that is doing, like your guest was talking about, number one, not letting a kid just have an unpleasant experience and throwing tantrums and all of that. But it's also not letting them do things on their own. Going in, solving their problems, doing their schoolwork for them, you know, running interference for them, that is not helpful to the child.
Sarah, is that something that you think German parents think, you know, where American parents go wrong?
Yes, I don't think they understood that we did that. In fact, they think, oh, well, I think sometimes we interfere too much. But then I would tell them what we do. It's very common in Germany for kids ages 7, 8 to walk to school on their own, or even to take the subway or the bus, or to go shopping. And that's considered part of their process of growing up. And I got to see the value of that through my own kids participating.
You write about the culture of control that American parenting has evolved into. Just how would you describe the difference between this idea that American parents feel like they have to exert control to protect their kids versus how Germans think about exerting, I guess, control over their kids? What's the difference?
Well, I mean, first of all, we have parents who are helicoptering, but what I also see happening in America is the entire culture around the kids and the parents emphasizing that the parents should control the kids. That this, we see this when people call the cops on parents if they let their kid walk to school.
Right.
You see this from the schools that make parents sign their kids' homework sheets to say that they did it, which is taking the responsibility away from the child. So there's this whole attitude in our culture that has become, we must control what kids do at almost every moment of the day. And what's very different in German culture is they had a huge reaction to the authoritarianism of the 1940s.
Hmm.
And so even today, they react very strongly against any effort, especially an official one, to control kids.
You know, Bobby, I was thinking that there's a lot of pressure within parenting culture to conform to that control, right? We've got a very, I think, shamey kind of parenting culture. And I think it forces parents maybe to be more controlling than they would naturally be. What do you think of that theory?
Yeah, I think there's kind of, it's a two-factor theory in some way where, to your point, Carrie, that, you know, we're really parenting from this, that's really cognitively distorted in some way, and it's really coming from a fear-based perspective. So, you know, if you ask a parent how they feel, you know, what's going to happen to their kid if they walk to school by themselves or the store, the parent would say, oh, well, I don't want them to get kidnapped, or, you know, what if someone, you know, pulls them in their car? But the reality is we are at a low, I think it's a 50-year low right now in terms of, you know, kind of random kidnapping. And there's actually a Harvard blogger that cited a U.S. Justice report stating that it would take an average of 26,000 years of a child sitting alone in a parking lot before that child was kidnapped by a stranger.
Wow, interesting.
50% of those kids would be returned.
Huh.
So, if we really...
so the threat just isn't as clear and present as parents think it is.
It's not really there, you know, but what parent wants to go on a limb and take that risk and
right.
have your kid be that 0.00016% of, you know, something happening? But the thing is, we really have to focus on that we're actually doing more harm. And, you know, we're raising these kids that are anxious and depressed, and I'm seeing them in my office. And, you know, it's like that is more pressing and more relevant than feeling like some random person's going to offer them candy and pull them in their van.
This is a conversation, if you've just gotten in on it, about the culture of American parenting and how it differs from what Sarah Zaski observed as she was in Germany and having children and watching how Germans parent, and then getting some expertise from German experts like a sleep consultant when her son wouldn't go to sleep and he'd say no and she didn't know what to do. She's written a book about it called Achtung Baby. We asked Bobby Wegner to be with us as well to tackle some of these deeper questions about the culture and actual techniques, right, that work. If this is resonating in your own household, this idea that we've created a culture of control, as Sarah writes, I mean, how does that look in your own family? Do you think the culture of American parenting is too cautious, is too hovering, is too shaming? 800-242-2828, 8651-227-6000 on Twitter, where a listener says, my mom always ignored me until I calmed down. Our cue in the grocery store was the line, do we need to go to the bathroom? We shut up real quick. What are your guests' thoughts on parents being equally embarrassing during tantrums? Sarah, you have a thought on that?
Well, I think it's part of our job as parents to be embarrassing.
Yeah, okay.
We shouldn't worry about what other people think, and really that's probably part of the American problem. Germans, of course, are famous for known for being very blunt and honest and not worried about hurting other people's feelings. But I have seen many a German parent standing still while their kid rages.
Have you really?
And
boy.
Sometimes that's, you just have to wait until they see that doesn't work and that they have the ability to calm themselves down, that they don't need somebody else to calm themselves.
I think that takes remarkable control. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
that also
you learn.
Yeah. Bobby, go ahead. You were going to say.
Well, that also speaks to, just as a culture, we're very intolerant of like any difficult emotion, as we would label it, whether it was sadness or anger. But really, all those emotions are really weighted equally, happiness, sadness, fear. And, you know, we see our kid freak out, become really sad or angry, and we feel like we need to make it go away or pass or help them through it.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it's helping them show that, you know, this is a normal part of human experience, and we have to help them that understand that they can tolerate this, that they can self-soothe, that this is going to come, they're going to feel sad or angry, and then it's going to pass, because that's what emotions do. And they can get back up and move on with their day.
I mean, this is
really something we need to communicate to our youngest kids so they can really internalize that and move on and be teenagers and college kids and young adults who could go out in the world and actually do this.
I mean, Bobby, some of what you're saying, I think, is connected to what Sharon, our therapist, our caller, was saying about you can't stop your kid from ever being hurt or uncomfortable or failing momentarily, right, by sweeping in to try to protect them. And that
right.
experience
and
of failing is valuable. Yeah.
It's actually a good thing. Like in our house, so I have three kids. I'm a parenting advocate and a psychologist and a lecturer, but I have my own three kids. So I go home and I'm dealing with this too. I have a 4-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 9-year-old. And I look for opportunities for them to figure it out and to fail. You know, that's like where the learning really happens. So, you know, it's you have to have a level of anxiety tolerance as a parent to be able to manage that.
Dale says on Twitter, wonderful conversation. I'm from the U.S. My wife is from Peru. We've always had a slightly hands-off parenting style, and we often felt judged by others. Now our 19-year-old is thriving at DePaul University when others are barely getting by. The shaming and judging is real. I will come back to the shaming because I think we have to talk more deeply about that. But to Nikki in Minneapolis. Hi, Nikki. How are you thinking about this?
Well, I'm thinking two things. One, I remember when Jacob Wetterling got kidnapped.
Yes.
And I vividly remember my parents and my friend's parents becoming much more, where are your kids going to be? Whose house are you going to? When before that, it was kind of six or eight of us. We lived in a fairly safe neighborhood, and we could just run around from house to house, cutting through yards and all these things. And then it was very much, okay, we need to know where you are. And I think that kind of scares parents in this area.
I think you're right.
And the other thing is, I work in retail, and I've seen the full-on screaming on the floor child tantrums when the parents say no, they can't have the toy.
Yeah.
And the thing that I observe more than anything else is all the other parents who stare at those parents and are like, can't you get your kid under control? Like, what's wrong with you as a parent? And it's like, no, that parent's actually doing something right. They're not getting the child the $100 toy because they're screaming. And you just feel bad for those parents because you want to help, but you don't intervene because there's nothing you can do. It's between the parent and the child. But, man, those parents feel that pressure.
Boy, and Nikki, I have to say, I am so guilty of that. You know, in a public place, when it goes on and on, you think, why can't these parents figure this out? Bobby, as a bystander, is there really anything you can do and speak to this culture of shaming, if you will?
You know what, I think it's really, you know, it does take a village, and that's very cliche, but I was at the grocery store the other day, and this woman was there with twin, like, 18 months old, and they were both just losing it. And then, you know, there it was a long line, and she was, and then the mom started crying.
Oh.
And everyone's just sitting there quietly, you know, like, oh God, can you get the kids to shut up? And the mom behind her just said, you know, you're doing a great job, and, like, this will pass or something like that. And it's like, if we can just encourage each other in those moments and actually come from a place of empathy rather than judgment,
mm-hmm.
and really look at the bigger picture, right? We're all connected as parents in this larger thing. And we all really just want the best for our kids. And that might look different for different families.
You know, Sarah, I was wondering if you think, this kind of goes with the shaming thing here, if we have a culture in the United States that doesn't really know the difference between appropriate risk and negligence, and whether you see the Germans having figured that out better than we have.
Yes. Well, for one thing, a risk is something that is manageable, and risk is something we can't get rid of completely. I think there's this false idea in the U.S. that we can keep our kids 100% safe if we just helicopter enough, if we just watch them enough, and that just simply isn't true. And we're failing as parents if we're trying to do that, because what we're trying to do is teach our kids how to manage risk for themselves, because they have to do that when they're adults.
Right.
And in Germany, they let those kids take those risks, from walking to school on their own to simply their playgrounds are much more riskier looking. And they have higher heights, and they have bridges that kind of shake when you walk on them. But they're not hazardous, and that's the difference. You know, a hazard is when you have a broken slide, you know, and there's nothing the kid can do but get hurt on it. But a risk is a really fast slide that they can manage when they're ready. So the kids can have a chance to try something that feels scary and succeed at it.
I'm sure when you were watching your kids on the playground, one of these playgrounds that looks a little riskier, you really, in the beginning, had to stop yourself from rushing in to, you know, to prevent some injury or something that probably wasn't going to happen anyway. How'd you get used to this?
I often was yelling, Achtung, which means kind of like attention or watch out. Like, it's a really strong word. And none of the other German parents were doing that. And they thought I was
funny.
A little bit crazy. And so, I learned to sit back and to realize that they will do what they're ready to do. You know, I watched my daughter deal with the dragon. We had a dragon in our park. It was really tall, but also scary looking. And she would go up the back of it and back down for years. She would never go down the slide. She would never sit in the mouth. And then one day when she was, I think, five, she called me, and I looked up, and she was sitting in the dragon's mouth. And that was her her achievement, you know, not mine. And I think that was a really big moment for her.
And you didn't have to yell out, "Aktong, you're in the dragon's mouth." Because she put herself there, right?
Exactly.
Call here from Marlo in Minneapolis. Hi, Marlo. You just dropped off a kid at daycare. Is that right?
I did. It's her first day. She's 19 months old.
Wow.
And this conversation is just really resonating with me. I just thought it was perfect timing and I had to call. So we're at a really interesting time right now because, you know, her whole infancy, we're kind of going with the motto of you can't spoil a baby, you know, give them as much love, attention and care as you can. But now that she's getting a little older and we want to help foster independence, you know, the advice is, you know, let them have that tantrum. The best thing you can do is ignore that and, you know, comfort them after they've calmed down. And I'm just wondering, you know, how do you have any advice for making that transition between infancy and childhood? And like what age do you start like considering letting them go to the playground by themselves? You know, things like that. And I live in the city too, so I feel like it maybe is a little more risky than living in the suburbs. I don't know, but
yeah.
Just wondering if you have any insight on that.
It's good. Bobby, that transition from spoiling to independence.
Sure. And, you know, I think parents often get stuck in, you know, we are, as infants, you get the message that you need to teach your kid that the world will respond. You need to, you know, kind of act when they show that they need something. And we're not suggesting that you go out and cut off your emotions and just let your kids, you know, feel what they feel and you don't respond. But it's sort of like changing position, right? You're kind of joining them in some way to you empathize and validate. That's sort of like parenting 101 or psychotherapy 101. So it's like you can hear their concern. You can hear what they want. You can validate that they're having a hard time dealing with that limit. But that's the limit. And you almost externalize it, not like I'm saying no to you because, you know, that's just it. But it's sort of like the limit is this outside thing. And you can support them around, you know, hearing no and what that might feel like for them. But no is still no. So, and in terms of actual age, you know, this is really different for each family and each kid. So it's hard to make a hard and fast rule. And in many states, there are actually there are no specific ages around, you know, when this is illegal or illegal. So in Massachusetts, it, you know, kind of free-range parenting is not illegal. But that doesn't mean, you know, DCF won't be called or something if your kid's walking home from the park. But for us in my family, I have a 9, a 7, and a 4-year-old, and we have sort of made a parenting pact with our neighbors, and we've committed to letting the kids run around. So my daughter, who's 4, has been roaming the neighborhood like probably for the past year or so.
Wow.
With her older brothers, and it's a mixed-aged group. So, you know, there's a 6th-grade girl and another 3rd-grade girl, and they kind of go together, and it feels like a bit of a leap of faith, but, you know, it's kind of a running joke among my friends that, you know, Eve would be fine if she were left home alone for like a week. She'd be the one who would get herself a snack or a drink and take care of everyone else.
She's 4.
She's 4. Right? She's been doing this, like, you know, a big part of this is when you endorse it, it's, you're welcoming a group of multi-aged, multi-gendered kids, and it just offers you. If you step back, you really see that kids step in, and it becomes their own little kind of hierarchy, political system, and it takes the pressure off the parents, and the kids enjoy it. It's just more pleasurable for everybody and less anxiety-riddled.
Hey, Marlo, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
This makes sense
She's
to you?
Like, oh my gosh,
oh,
I'm
yeah.
up.
Yeah, no, it really resonates with me. I think you did a really good job of addressing exactly what I was trying to say. And I remember being a kid also and my parents letting us just run through the neighborhood with our friends. And you bring up a good point. If you're with other kids, that's different than just letting your kid wander around on their own.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So, yeah,
so
no,
I
that's
probably
great.
Would be, you know, when it was my firstborn, if he were by himself as a 4-year-old or a 3-year-old, that wouldn't be happening. But, you know, my daughter, she's in a group now, and when we first started getting comfortable with this, it was probably when my oldest was around 5, and we live pretty close to the public school, like a block and a half away. So I'd help him cross the street, and then he'd walk the rest of his way to kindergarten. So that's how we started with this. And then, you know, we kind of
expand the parameters as we go. And I actually got walkie-talkies, and my neighbors got them too.
Great.
And I gave them to the kids. So they're on their own. You're avoiding the whole cell phone thing. But if I need them home or I just want to know where they are, you know, I can reach them. And if I don't reach them, then I would get concerned.
Then you're then you're starting to look. Right.
Yeah.
Andrea, Marlo, thanks for the call. Provoked a good discussion there. Andrea says, yes, we're too protective and controlling. The rest of the world laughs at us for not even allowing children to use the bathroom without teachers' permission. We have long been creating a teacup generation that's too fragile to handle hardship. Thanks for the discussion to Iola in St. Paul. Iola, you sound like you're a little skeptical to this. Hi.
Yes. Okay. It's not skeptical. So I'm a mom of five.
And wow.
So my kids have to be self-reliant because there's three that are three and under.
Yeah.
With that, it comes, like, I laugh because I'm just like, yeah, that's great. But parenting in Germany versus St. Paul, or not St. Paul, in the U.S., starts at birth. So with that said, we Germans, they get time off with their kids. We don't get that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's almost kind of comparing apples to oranges. Not only that, but there's a whole nother level for my children. I wouldn't let them go out. There's a tad bit of privilege that says, well, I can let my kids go out in my neighborhood and not have to worry about it. And they can go out with all the other kids and they'll be fine. There is a tad bit of a lot of privilege in that. Because not everyone has that. And as a mother of black children and a history of children being shot at a playground for just playing, I would never do that and never allow my children to do that.
Sarah, to Iola's point about, you know, this begins at, well, prenatal in Germany, and they bring a lot more resources, right, to the idea of parenting than from the state than the U.S. government does. Yes?
Yeah, right. Absolutely. And it's something that we should demand more of, frankly. You know, yes, they have 5 weeks of vacation there. Everybody has it. You can have maternity leave up to 3 years, so most people just take one, and then they have subsidized childcare. Rather than thinking that means we could never have that here, to me that says, wow, it's possible, because Germany is not a failing economy, as we're told will happen if we get all these things. I think as parents that we can start to demand more for family life, because it really is necessary for kids. But I would also put out there that most of the Germans I met, because I lived in Berlin, a big city, worked. And so their kids being self-reliant made things a lot easier for them. If they could walk home from school by themselves or take themselves to an after-school activity, it made the whole family organization work better. And so there are still some things that we can do. Now, to the question she raised about the inequality that is in America, that is also a very poignant point. When we say there is a lot less crime in America than there used to be, that is absolutely true, pretty much across the board, except in certain pockets, and those are usually more poor places. And that's another area that we should really fight for kids to have the right to be outside. And there are things we can do in that area, too. Like, for instance, if we have a bad neighborhood, what if we put out school resource officers in the morning along the route to school so that the kids could walk to school on their own? That's one way that we could at least give them more independence.
Iola, does that make sense to your question?
It does, yeah. But then it's adding officers to the neighborhood, especially to neighborhoods that already. It's such a complex issue.
It
and
is.
I'm not asking for like someone to figure out right now. It's such a complex issue. But yeah, like even adding school officers, I'm like, oh no, I wouldn't. No, because my neighborhood already doesn't trust the officers.
Right.
Why would they add more? So yeah, it's a complex issue, and I'm not asking for an answer today. It's just something I thought I'd bring up.
I'm glad you raised it. Yeah, and I'm glad you were tuned in. Sarah Zaski with us, if you've just gotten in on the conversation here, talking with her about her new book, Achtung Baby, subtitle, An American Mom on the German Art of Raising Self-Reliant Children. So that gives you a sense of what we're talking about. Dr. Bobbi Wegner is with us. She's a clinical psychologist and lecturer and mother of three kids. Bobbi, what are their ages?
4, 7, and 9.
Yeah, so you're right in the middle of this.
I'm in it, yeah.
Right. To Chad in Hastings. Hi, Chad. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hey, thank you. I just wanted to give a few observations as a parent of some younger kids and kind of from a coaching perspective, too. I've seen, as a coach for sports, that parents are really, or these kids are really ready for their parents to always take care of them, specifically during, like, let's say during soccer. Mm-hmm. I've seen them where they trip, they fall, they hit the ground, and quickly they're looking for help. Oh, I fell. Someone come help me. Someone come help me. And as a coach, and I think I kind of surprised a lot of parents where I just walked up to the kid and I can tell they just tripped. Hey, get up. Keep playing. Why are you laying around? And I've had this kind of attitude toward these kids all the time as a coach. I've actually had to get to the point of emailing the parents and say, hey, this is my style. I expect kids to get up. We're not there. They need to learn that they will trip. They will fall. But they can always get up and keep going. I've had parents come up to me and say, hey, little Timmy can't play with Johnny because they don't get along. Well, honestly, as a coach, I'm looking at them as like, that's just too bad. They're going to have to learn to get along. This is just, I don't know, maybe as a metaphor for life, right? They're going to have to learn to get along. But as a coach, it's my job to kind of push.
I wonder, Chad, do you get pushback from the parents on this?
I haven't got much when they've seen success that it works and it's just different for them that they, example, I had a parent that had a child that I believe had some developmental challenges. And they said, you know what, I think I'm going to pull my kid out because they're a little too shy. They're not able to play. And I was like, no, don't pull them out. Give me a chance. I'll find a way to make it, to incorporate them into the play. And there is, there's just, you know, maybe limit the playing time in 1 minute, out the next, in 1 minute, out the next. And when the parents see that, they've actually approached me playing time and said, wow, I really can't believe that it's working. And I just think it's, you know, I tell the parents, listen, I'm the coach. I'm not a parent. I'm not their friend. Mm-hmm. And I do this with my kids too. I am not my kids' parents or my kids' friends at all. I'm a parent. Now that might mean that I do get to do things that friends do. We play, we wrestle, we teach, we have a great time, but I'm a parent. At the end of the day, I have to be the parent. I'm not going to be your friend. And you got to let these kids learn from their mistakes. One of my kids likes to play with tools and they're young. And I've explained to him, hey, listen, here's the bottom line. These are dangerous things. You need to respect them, but you will get hurt no matter what. I've gotten hurt plenty of times. And they couldn't believe that I was saying that the kid's going to get hurt. Like, my kid's going to get hurt. And guess what? I let him play. I monitor, of course, so there's nothing over the top dangerous. But my kid got hurt, cut himself within the first week. Said, Dad, you were right. I hurt myself. Perfect.
Well,
here's how you fix it. Get back to it.
I wonder what Bobby's making of this as she listens to this. Bobby?
No, I think it's wonderful. You know, I think listening to you, Chad, it made me realize, or think back to, there's a famous developmental psychologist named Piaget, and he really talks about how our cognitions and the way we think are formed and our moral development. And that really happens between the ages of like 6 and 10. So if we're waiting for kids to be older, like 12, 13, 16, to start going out on their own, you've kind of missed the window in some way. You have this captive audience now where you're trying to teach kids to trust themselves, to rely on themselves, to push the envelope in some way, to reach for things, and how to deal with failure and how to take care of themselves. So if we wait too long, the window's almost like closed in some way. Hmm. And as a culture, we're doing parents a disservice telling them like, oh, wait, like hold your children closer to you. But by the time they're in their high school years, it's like the way they think about the world is already set in many ways.
Yeah. You know, Sarah, when we were talking about your book, one of our producers said that she has German friends. And she sees that the German fathers are much more involved in making the core decisions of parenting for kids. Did you see that?
I saw that a lot in Berlin, that parenting seemed to be more of a dual role. And you saw it when they came to pick up the kids from school. It wasn't all moms. And when at the PTA-type meetings, it was the dads were there as well, which was really nice. And you know, in terms when he was talking about using tools, that's introduced fairly early in Germany. My daughter was cutting fruit for class when she was 4 years old, and from there they learned how to light matches, which we don't do here, at 6 and 7, and they learned how to use building tools as well. It's considered part of the process.
Wow. Call here from Robin in St. Paul. Hi, Robin. Thanks for waiting. I know it's been a while. What do you... Oh, shoot. We just lost Robin. I think Robin was going to ask about raising young women to be independent and, you know, what parenting looks like with that, Bobby, especially if your daughter is among a group of peers, you know, who are more restrictive. So,
right.
Yeah.
So kind of raising independent girls is sort of the question. You know, I'm really, I think this comes to, it applies to both boys and girls. I'm actually doing a lot of research on this now. I'm giving a TEDx talk on the importance of raising conscious boys, but it really comes down to providing children at a very early age kind of equal opportunity to explore, to send the message that, you know, I trust my daughter, I trust my son, I expect them both to go out in the yard and to kind of play, and I'm not, you know, kind of setting these gender norms in some way. And the reality is we all do this. You know, the culture in which we live is incredibly gendered, and we all have implicit gender bias.
Mm-hmm.
So we make assumptions or respond to our girls and boys differently from a very early age. And I think one really nice thing about free-range parenting is that it kind of, I wouldn't say equalizes that, but normalizes it a little bit and, you know, gives girls the message that they can take care of themselves, that they can be independent, that they can explore, and those are messages that I want my daughter to get.
Sarah, you have a daughter now, too. How old is Sophia, right?
She's 11 now.
Okay. So how does that fit with what you were thinking, this idea of the exploration being less kind of maneuvering kids into gender roles?
Well, it was interesting when we first arrived back in the U.S., we were in California in a very safe suburb, and my daughter was 9 at the time, and she was the only girl biking to and from school.
Really?
There were boys going to and from school. It's interesting that we feel that they are better able to take care of themselves than girls. However, you know, her example, her friends started getting more interested in their bikes, and the next fall, there were a lot more kids biking to school. I think it's some matter of just allowing it to happen. I don't think girls are in any more danger than boys are on their own. And my daughter is actually, you know, very independent and very responsible. You know, if she goes somewhere, if she needs something, she knows to call. And those are the things, you know, somebody was asking before about knowing when your child can do these things.
Yeah.
Those are the kind of signs I look for. And, of course, we went many times together. So we kind of trained her for walking to school or riding to school before she did it on her own.
Meredith says on Twitter, our kids are overscheduled because we can't let them play outside unsupervised anymore. Everything is parent-driven. I don't know how to escape this lifestyle. We desperately need a culture shift. And to Casey in St. Paul. Casey, you're a teacher. Really glad you called in.
Yeah, I'm a first grade teacher in St. Paul, and it's a great conversation. I was just wondering how the German school early education model compares to ours. In my classroom, at the beginning of the year, a lot of the students are quiet. And by the end of the year, I have to tell them to be quiet, but I want them to speak up, especially the girls.
Mm. Yeah.
You don't teach independence, you give independence. And sometimes, as I say to my family, to them, it ain't no fun until somebody gets hurt. And that's where the learning takes place.
Well, that's interesting. That's kind of a flip on the usual.
Yeah, well, you know, they were talking about the playgrounds in Germany. We just got a new playground at our school. And the things don't go fast. The teeter-totter goes up about 4 inches, you know. And so I just think giving kids independence is, I like the Piaget model, but I'm more into the Vygotsky, or however you pronounce that. Social consciousness comes through social interactions. So I think they need a lot of social interactions.
Yes. So let me ask Bobby what she makes of that.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. Kids need opportunities to learn and to engage, and you know, it really comes from practice, not telling, right? You kind of have to like offer the opportunity and not just kind of say that you are for this.
You know, Sarah, I was thinking about how I think at a point in the book you emphasize the fact that German schools weave a lot of outdoor breaks into the day. Do I remember that right?
Yes. So first of all, I would love to have so many American educators come see a German kindergarten because they are complete chaos. They are
really
screaming, running around and playing. But first grade, which is taken very seriously, they even have a ceremony before you start school, is still pretty much half day. And even within that half day, they have two recesses. So play is still considered really important. They get a little bit more hours as the years go on, but still there's at least two recesses and a really long lunch.
I wonder why American schools, I don't know if it's trying to cram more content into the school day or what, why we've moved away from that. And by the way, I think, Sarah, I remember you saying that even if the weather is bad, the kids are out there.
That's right. That's a value in a lot of Northern Europe. And the Germans say, you know, there's no such thing as bad weather, only it's suitable clothing. They will bundle their kids up in, you know, snowsuits and what they call mutzes, which is kind of a hat that goes around your entire face, and send the kids outside in almost any weather.
Is it snowing in Moscow, Idaho today? Because it's snowing here in St. Paul. I don't know how many kids are going out for recess today. Right?
Yeah, but, you know, my kids got used to it in Germany, and it's almost like the worse the weather, the more my son, who's now 8, wants to go out in it.
Really? Wow.
He likes to put on his boots. He likes to put on all his gear and go out there and explore.
Mm. Question here from Margaret in St. Paul. Hi, Margaret. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have comments on, I just love every part of this conversation.
Good.
I am a mom of 3 and 2, 6, and 4. And my question is, so I'm a stay-at-home mom, and for the most part, I love the teachings of, you know, Brené Brown and Glennon Doyle of don't teach your kids to avoid fire, but teach them they can be fireproof and really kind of mm-hmm. let them get hurt, experience pain, move through it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is 1,000% easier said than done because, you know, the first time my son got on the bus for school, I, you know, had a panic attack and wanted to put a tracking device on him. So it takes a lot of practice, but because I'm a stay-at-home mom, I get to do that, to practice with them, to see them overcome things. And my husband, you know, for the most part, we're on the same page with parenting, but there are certain things that there's a lot of conflict. And when, as a mom, you kind of doubt yourself, at least I do, on a daily basis, on am I doing this right? Am I screwing them up? You know, what do you do then when you're trying to convince your husband what you believe is right?
So, different parenting styles, especially on something like this. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, for the kids not to see that conflict and then trickle down for whatever reason. So, yeah, that's my question. How do you navigate that as
good
a couple?
Good one. Bobby, how would you answer that?
Yeah. You know, I think there's this idea, you know, as parents, we have this idea that you come in, and it's going to be natural and you're going to know what to do. But the reality is all parents, regardless of your experience, are doing this for the first time. And many of us, actually all of us, don't really know what we're doing. Some of us might have more experience, but it's all new to all of us when you're a first-time parent. But one kind of framework that I really focus on with the parents that I work with is really getting clear with your husband about 3 priorities. So, you know, kind of, you know, I call it the frame, but it's naming 3 things that are absolutes in your family. Like, you know, my kid won't leave the yard without telling me. My kid is to come tell me if X, Y, and Z happens, or whatever it is for you. It could be anything. Whatever you prioritize, and get really clear with your husband and on the same page about those 3 things. And then pretty much take your hands off the rest. So, you know, you can think about the metaphor of the playground. So you draw a tight, tight structure around the things you really care about, but you have to be careful not to come up with too many things. It has to be like 3 or 4. And then everything else is like hands off in some way.
Well,
with lots of freedom.
Bobby, what do you mean hands off? I mean, you're just...
Yeah, so using the playground metaphor, so, you know, say you're at the playground, and Sarah actually kind of alluded to this, that, you know, she's watching her kid go down the slide and looks dangerous, and she's sort of calling to him to be careful, but instead, like, sitting back and saying, you know what, that's not something I'm going to worry about.
Yeah.
That's more managing my own anxiety around what I'm expecting is going to happen, but if he falls, he falls, and then, you know, that's kind of what happens. But if he goes to leave the playground, that's an absolute no, and there are going to be consequences, and I'm going to be firm about it. But everything in the middle is sort of fair game.
Wow.
And I think when you start parenting from that model, I think it's important to also find people in your neighborhood or people that you spend time with who subscribe to this, because
yeah.
it's so much easier. It becomes almost like a healthy peer pressure. You know, I find myself going to the playground and watching parents follow their kids around, and I start parenting out of kind of embarrassment or fear or shame, and I have to catch myself on that and be like, you know what, that's not what I want for my kids, so I'm going to saddle up on the bench and drink my coffee and, you know, my kids know where I am. And I think that's more typical in other cultures, but here the norm is to kind of track your kids every move on the playground.
Yeah. So Sarah, that is something that I was curious about for you. Now that you've had this experience in Germany and written about it, and you're back in the U.S. and parenting in Idaho, do you find yourself out of sync with a lot of what the parents around you are doing?
Sometimes, yeah. But I also, when I talk to parents one-on-one, I often hear this sentence, I wish I could let my kids do that.
What does that really mean, do you think?
That they're more concerned about the judgment of the fellow parents.
Wow.
And I'm hearing in the news about people getting the police called on them. But I think there's power in numbers. And what I often say, and I think Bobby mentioned this before, is if it feels unsafe, you know, to let your kid walk to school, find another kid. Because that feels safer. And I think even to a stranger's eye, seeing a group of three or four kids walking to school does not look unsafe.
Right.
Or same thing at the playground. And the playground is way more fun if there are more kids. And one thing that I've borrowed as well from Lenore Skenazy is to try to plan a day at the park to get all the kids out there at once. You know, we're going out Wednesday. Everybody's going to be there.
And the purpose of that is what?
Well.
Just to have parents be kind of in solidarity and watching the kids interact with each other?
The ones that feel they need to come and watch can come and watch. But then if you see a big group of kids, when the parents are there, they sort of realize, I don't really need to be here, you know, because the kids are playing with each other. They're having a great time.
Bobby, I find it hard to believe that anybody really questions your parenting credentials. I mean, given that you're a clinical psychologist and, you know, an expert on child development here. But it's interesting to hear you say there are times you're around other parents and you catch yourself feeling the pressure to parent like that.
No, I feel it. And that's what kind of drove me in some way into this, because I, you know, if I'm feeling this way, many parents feel this way.
I
know that this is healthy and it's good. And then I show up at the playground or I'm letting my kid, you know, walk down to the coffee shop and I'm, you know, kind of hold my breath wondering if someone's going to call. And, you know, but for me, I really have to be clear that this is important to me and that this is a choice that my husband and I are making as parents because we care so deeply and because we want to create these opportunities for our kids. And at a playground, nobody knows that, you know, I'm a clinical psychologist or parenting person or child advocacy. They're just judging, right?
Right. Bobby, it's been great to have you on the show. Thanks so much. Good
Thank
to have you,
you
here.
Thank you for having me. It's been such a great conversation. I'm just so happy we're talking about this.
I am too. Bobby Wagner with us. She's a clinical psychologist and a lecturer at Harvard Graduate School of Education. Sarah, you will be interested to know that we've been getting apparently a lot of calls about picky eaters. I don't know if this comes up and the difference. I have about a minute left, but if you wanted to say something about that.
Well, generally, I give them the responsibility of what they want to eat, but that means I'm not a restaurant.
Okay.
You know, I put out what's on the table. And these are your choices. And, you know, if they don't have if they don't feel like eating any of it, then they, you know, get hungry. In Germany, they learned this because nobody brought their lunches to school. You had to eat, you know, the one of two choices that the
cafeteria school is serving. Yeah.
Yep.
Sarah, this has been fun. Thanks so much. Really great book.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Sarah Zaski's book is called Achtung Baby. By the way, we did a whole roundtable on picky eaters. Boy, that was a great discussion. You can find it on the podcast. So if you're curious about how picky eating fits in on this, there's the podcast for you whenever you're ready to listen to it. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller, wherever you get your podcasts.
This
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.